From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Yesterday, in a decision by a federal court, the court ruled that the administration was wrong. The president doesn't have the authority power to detain Jose Padilla as an enemy combatant without any judicial process.
We believe the Second Circuit ruling is troubling and flawed. The president has directed the Justice Department to seek a stay and further judicial review.
Today, a debate on Padilla versus Rumsfeld. Also, the court ruled prisoners on Guantanamo Bay have their right to a day in court. And in a triple blow for the administration, the Inspector General of the Justice Department has issued an explosive report on immigrant detainees, saying prison workers in Brooklyn abused immigrants arrested after the September 11th attacks. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration's post-911 anti-terrorism tactics were dealt a triple blow by federal courts. In New York, a federal appeals court ruled the government cannot detain U.S. citizen Jose Padilla indefinitely without pressing charges against him or allowing him access to court. Padilla has been held incommunicado as an enemy combatant on a South Carolina naval brig for over a year and a half. No charges have ever been filed against him. He's barred from seeing his lawyer. Hours after that ruling came down, a federal appeals court in San Francisco ruled the government's treatment of foreign detainees on Guantanamo Bay is unconstitutional and a violation of international law. In addition, Thursday, the Inspector General's Office of the Justice Department released a detailed report describing rampant abuse of 911 detainees inside a government-run detention center in Brooklyn, New York. We'll have more on all of these stories in just a few minutes. In Iraq, Reuters is reporting the U.S. has banned all forms of protest against the U.S. occupation around Saddam Hussein's birthplace of Tikrit. After a recent rally in support of Saddam Hussein, U.S. military vehicles and tanks raced through the streets. One of the vehicles broadcast a recording of the U.S.-backed regional governor in the area. His message, quote, "Any demonstration against the government or coalition forces will be fired upon. This is a fair warning," unquote. According to Reuters, all demonstrations have been declared illegal in the province. Iraqis face a year in jail for participating in a protest, and any Iraqi civil servants or teachers who participate in protests will lose their jobs. Reuters reported one military officer warned a local Iraqi in Tikrit not to organize any protests. The U.S. officer said, quote, "Let me make something very clear. If our ears and eyes see and hear you are connected with demonstrations and anti-coalition activities, you will be going to jail for a very long time," unquote. The top U.S. official overseeing the occupation has confirmed he survived an assassination attempt in Iraq 2 weeks ago. An NBC report said Paul Bremer's convoy was hit by an explosive device and came under fire. The attack came on the same day that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was visiting Iraq. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that auditors at the Pentagon are accusing Halliburton of refusing to hand over internal documents released related to allegations that the oil service company overcharged the U.S. government in Iraq. The Wall Street Journal reports Halliburton may have overcharged the government by a total of $100 million. Newly declassified documents show that now Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld went to Baghdad in March 1984 with instructions to deliver a private message about weapons of mass destruction. The Washington Post reports the message was that Washington's public criticism of Iraq for using chemical weapons would not derail Washington's attempts to forge a better relationship. The March 1984 visit was Rumsfeld's second visit to Iraq on behalf of President Ronald Reagan. 20 years ago tomorrow, Rumsfeld met with Saddam Hussein in Baghdad. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon Thursday warned he would take unilateral actions in the occupied territories to entirely isolate the Palestinian population if the Palestinian leadership does not take increased actions against militants. Sharon outlined a plan of what he called unilateral separation. Under the plan, Israel would greatly accelerate the building of a controversial wall through the West Bank. Israel would consolidate settlers into larger, more fortified settlements. The number of Israeli troops in the West Bank and Gaza would increase to protect these new, larger settlements. According to the Guardian of London, the Palestinians would end up with a shrunken state crisscrossed by heavily protected Jewish settlements. Sharon warned, quote, if Israel unilaterally draws a border, the Palestinians will receive much less than they would have received through direct negotiations. Sharon's threat was received poorly by both Palestinians and the United States. At the White House, Press Secretary Scott McClellan said, quote, the United States believes a settlement must be negotiated, and we would oppose any Israeli effort, to impose a settlement. Palestinian chief negotiator Saeb Erekat told CNN, with this unilateral approach, they may make peace with Israelis. They'll not make peace with Palestinians. And in Washington, a jury has found teen sniper Lee Boyd Malvo guilty on two counts of capital murder for his role in the killing of 10 people last year. He faces life in prison or the death penalty. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers around the country. And Amy, quite a few stunning decisions in the courts yesterday. And the Padilla case, the Jose Padilla case, I've actually written several columns on it in the New York Daily News on, because many people consider it probably the biggest challenge to constitutional liberties in the post-9/11 era. So we're going to get right to that. The Bush administration was dealt a double blow yesterday when two federal court rulings undermined the Bush administration's detention policy of suspected terrorists. In New York, a divided court ruled that President Bush lacked the authority to indefinitely detain Jose Padilla, a U.S. citizen, simply by declaring him an enemy combatant. Hours later in San Francisco, federal judges ruled the administration's policy of imprisoning some 600 non-citizens on a naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, without access to United States legal protections, was unconstitutional as well as a violation of international law.
And in addition, the Inspector General's Office at the Justice Department released a detailed report describing rampant abuse of 9/11 detainees inside the government-run detention center in Brooklyn, New York. In the Jose Padilla case, the majority of the three-judge panel ruled that while Congress might have the power to authorize the detention of an American, the president, acting on his own, did not. Padilla has been held in solitary confinement for 18 months without access to a lawyer or the courts. No charges have been filed against him. Padilla is a U.S. citizen born in Brooklyn. The court gave the government 30 days to charge Padilla, release him, or hold him as a material witness.
The evidence against Padilla came under question soon after his arrest in May of 2002. One congressional staffer who was briefed on the case said, quote, not many people were satisfied that we had a hell of a whole lot on him. The White House said it would have to seek to have the ruling overturned and directed the Justice Department to seek a stay. White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan yesterday addressed the Padilla ruling. This is what he had to say.
The Second Circuit ruling is troubling and flawed. The president has directed the Justice Department to seek a stay and further judicial review. This is a case in which an individual was involved with terrorist organization activity and was actively engaged in an effort to do harm to the American people.
And why couldn't that be adjudicated in some way by going through the regular court system instead of making him an enemy combatant?
Well, first of all, let's remember what we're talking about. We're talking about an individual who is involved in seeking to do harm to the American people. And the president has repeatedly said that his most solemn obligation and responsibility is to protect the American people. And the Second Circuit's ruling is really inconsistent with the clear constitutional authority of the president and his responsibility that I just mentioned, and with previous circuit and Supreme Court rulings. The Fourth Circuit previously ruled on a similar matter, and it upheld the authority of the president to designate enemy combatants. So let's keep all that in mind. The president is going to continue aggressively pursuing the war on terror and do everything he can to prevent an attack from happening in this country.
White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. Today we're going to have a debate on the case. We're joined by Barbara Olshansky, Assistant Legal Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which submitted a brief to the court criticizing the government for holding enemy combatants. She's the author of Secret Trials and Executions, Military Tribunals and the Threat to Democracy. On the phone with us from Washington is Richard Sapp. He is Chief Counsel of the Washington Legal Foundation, which submitted a brief to the court backing the government on its enemy combatant policy on behalf of three Republican members of Congress, Walter Jones of North Carolina, Lamar Smith of Texas, and John Sweeney of New York. Richard Sapp, let's begin with you. The significance of the ruling yesterday.
Quite significant, not for the reasons that most people had expected it to be, but rather it's a ruling that significantly cuts back on the power of the president to conduct foreign policy. Most people, including myself, believe that the Constitution squarely puts the foreign policy power into the hands of the president. The Court of Appeals seemed to think that no, really it resides either in the courts or in Congress, and said that the president can't do pretty much of anything to defend the country, at least within the domestic sphere, without the specific endorsement of Congress.
And Barbara Olshansky, your interpretation of the court's ruling?
Well, I really view it very differently. I think this decision really didn't have to do with foreign policy. It had to do with the exercise of the president's war powers in domestic civil society. And that's something that Congress has explicitly denied the president in the anti-detention statute. And by the way, that's something that is deeply embedded in the history of democracy in this country and of our Constitution. The separation of powers is a very strong principle that's inherent in this democracy from time immemorial.
And specifically in the case of Jose Padilla, what exactly does this mean?
Well, it's a very interesting situation where the designation by the president of enemy combatant status, which, by the way, there really is no such status in international humanitarian law, but that designation was used to put Mr. Padilla in solitary confinement for 18 months without access to counsel or the courts. And what that meant is that no one gets to review that designation by the president. And in the court papers, what the government said is that they don't plan to charge him with any crime. They don't even allege that he was a member of Al-Qaeda. What they were keeping him for was investigative purposes. And in this country, we don't have investigative detention. And so what this court said is the president clearly overstepped his constitutional boundaries. We don't arrest American citizens on American soil, far from the theater of war, and put them in indefinite investigative detention. We just don't do that.
Richard Sapp, I'd like to get back to this issue that you raise of foreign, the courts intervening in foreign policy issues. Certainly, the case that the court seemed to refer to the most, the Anti-Detention Act that was passed by Congress, actually it was in response to the Japanese detentions of World War II, and it was in the 70s that Congress said that the president cannot detain American citizens without specific authorization of Congress. And the appeals court decision seems to weigh heavily on that you've got to have a president, even in time of war, a president has to have congressional authorization to be able to detain U.S. citizens on U.S. soil.
Well, that's what they held. My understanding is that that has never been the law before yesterday. And as you mentioned in your prior story, this decision directly conflicts on that point with a decision from the Federal Appeals Court in Richmond. I would agree with everything Mr. Shansky said, that the detention of an American citizen raises serious questions. And the serious questions that were before the appeals court but that they failed to decide were, what level of review are you going to give somebody like that? Because obviously some review is required. And furthermore, are you going to give that person access to counsel? And those are very important questions that I think are troubling to all Americans. But instead of ruling on those issues, the court just simply said flat out, we are going to deny the war power to our commander-in-chief to make these kind of decisions. That's totally unprecedented.
Barbara Olshansky.
You know, in fact, I really don't think it's unprecedented. I think, Juan, what you were saying about the anti-detention statute is very apt here. I think the legislative history was really clear. When Congress was passing this act, it was overturning an emergency detention act that was used to intern thousands of Japanese Americans. And if you look at the legislative history and what congressmen and senators said, they said, we don't ever want this mistake again. Even in a time of war, we don't do this within American society and civil society to American citizens. And so they expressly deny the president that authority. And the thing is, if you're looking for precedent, there's a significant difference between Mr. Hamdi and Mr. Padilla. Mr. Hamdi's circumstances under which he was detained are very different. Mr. Padilla was arrested in O'Hare Airport, unarmed, and the government now admits that they really don't and they haven't had the basis for criminal charges against him. So those circumstances are different. If you look to the past for ex parte
whereas in the other case, the Hamdi case, Hamdi was actually captured on the battlefield,
right.
An American citizen captured on the battlefield in Afghanistan, very similar to John Walker Lind, who,
right.
By the way, did get his day in court in the United States.
Yes, he did, and I think that's a very interesting point. And I think, you know, the analysis that the courts have undertaken stems from this case called Youngstown, when President Truman tried to take over the steel mills to make sure that they were going to be operating during a time of war. And what the court said is, there are these tiers of presidential power, and when the presidential power comes into conflict with what Congress has explicitly denied him, then there's a role for the federal courts. And at a very basic level, what this case is about is, you know, is the executive going to be reviewed by the judiciary? Do judges get to look at what the administration is doing and say whether it's constitutional or not? And at each intersection that we've had with this administration, they have said basically to the district court, to other courts, you don't get to review it. And in a sense, Richard is right, because You know, that issue, the way that it was posed to the district court was, well, can you really look at what the evidence that was put forward? And the idea was, well, we'll do this standard where you get to look just at the document. Is this an affidavit? Okay, that's all the court gets to say. And what the court is saying here is, no, our constitutional obligation is to look hard at whether the president has this authority. And they said no.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we'll come back with this discussion. Barbara Olshansky, Assistant Legal Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Richard Sapp, Chief Counsel of the Washington Legal Foundation. They have both submitted opposing briefs in the Padilla versus Rumsfeld case. We're also going to be speaking with a lawyer who has just returned from Guantanamo, where for the first time he was able to see his client. We'll hear what he has to say. Stay with us. John Coltrane, Spiritual, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our guest. Barbara Olshansky is the Assistant Legal Director for the Center of Constitutional Rights. Her book is called Secret Trials and Executions. Richard Sapp is on the line with us from Washington, Chief Counsel of the Washington Legal Foundation. Juan?
Yes, I'd like to continue the debate here. And Richard Sapp, on the issue, you raised the Richmond case, which was actually, I think, the D.C. Was it the D.C. Circuit that ruled in Hamdi's case that he was and that the president had the powers to declare him an enemy combatant?
But no, actually, that was the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit in Richmond. The case that was from the D.C. Circuit was the one involving Guantanamo Bay.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Well, in that case, though, the Richmond court specifically said, as I understand it, that in a section of their decision, they were pointing to not that they were not dealing with the Padilla case. In fact, they said, we have no occasion, for example, to address the designation of an enemy combatant of an American citizen captured on American soil or the role that counsel might play in such a proceeding. So they seem to be specifically, even that rather conservative court was seeming to say, hey, we're not going to have Hamdi, our decision on Hamdi, apply to Padilla itself. So they even apparently had some concerns about the extent, in this case, of actually arresting an American citizen on American soil.
I think you're at least partially right there. They did make a point of distinguishing the two cases factually. What the court ruled in that case, though, was as a preliminary ruling, they said there is no question that the president has the authority to detain American citizens, and they did that not only on the basis of a different understanding of the Constitution than was indicated yesterday by the Second Circuit, but they also did it on the basis that they looked at the joint resolution that was adopted by Congress following 9/11, and they looked at the legislative history of that act and said there was no question in their mind that Congress intended to give the authority to the president to detain people in connection with the fight against Al-Qaeda. And all the the prior anti-detention laws had said was you need to get authority from Congress. And what the Fourth Circuit said was they did get that authority. So I think that, yes, there are significant factual differences between the two cases, but that they're on that one point of law, they are precisely the same. And that's what leads me to suspect very strongly that the U.S. Supreme Court will review yesterday's decision in order to resolve that conflict.
So right now, Jose Padilla, they have 30 days, and he's either got to be released or brought into a civilian court. Is that right?
That's right.
And what exactly do you think will happen within this 30 days?
Well, I think it's clear from what Scott McClellan said that the government is going to seek a stay and then appeal the decision. So I think the court should deny that stay. I think if he's in criminal detention, then, you know, he's of no danger to anyone, to the extent that they think that there's a danger. But it's difficult to say whether the court will say that he has to stay in military detention while they decide the case en banc.
Now, a federal appeals court in San Francisco, in a second blow to the administration, ruled 2-1 that the administration's policy of imprisoning about 660 non-citizens on a naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, without access to legal protections, quote, raises the gravest concerns under both American and international law. The ruling's essentially symbolic, since the Supreme Court already agreed last month to review a case that upheld the Bush policy, which denies court access to the prisoners at the base. Can you talk about the significance of this ruling? Let's start with Richard Samp.
Well, I agree with what you said, that it is largely symbolic because the Supreme Court will already be looking at the issue. In terms of how much weight it will be given by the Supreme Court, I think the answer probably is not much. It was written by Stephen Reinhardt, who was considered among the most liberal and most frequently reversed of the Ninth Circuit judges. Also, I want to point out the issue really was not on the merits of the detention. What it had to do with was whether the United States courts have jurisdiction at all to hear claims by overseas aliens who are not within the United States. The D.C. Circuit said no jurisdiction. The Ninth Circuit said that there was jurisdiction. So Reinhardt, while he had some language expressing concerns about the policy, was not ruling at all on the merits of the policy.
But didn't most of the decision revolve around the question of whether Guantanamo Bay was U.S. territory?
Yes, it did. If Guantanamo Bay, in fact, should be considered the same as U.S. territory, then these people are within the United States and therefore are entitled to access to the American courts. That is a jurisdictional issue, not to the merits of whether or not it's okay to be holding them.
We're also joined on the telephone by Stephen Kenny. He is an Australian lawyer who became the first attorney to visit a detainee on Guantanamo Bay. He has just returned. Australian prisoner David Hicks is his client. You can go to democracynow.org, our website, and review the interview we had with his father, who came to protest David Hicks' imprisonment in Guantanamo. Hicks was captured in northern Afghanistan as a suspected Taliban fighter in 2001. We are joined by Stephen Kenny. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Can you talk about what you saw on Guantanamo? How is your client, David Hicks, and your reaction to the ruling of the court?
I can't really talk about a lot of what I saw on Guantanamo Bay. That's quite restricted. Generally, it's a naval base, but on which a large prison camp has been erected. I can't talk about the conditions in which David is being held, except to say that David had previously written to his family saying that he is now held in isolation and all he sees is MPs. As for how he is, he's not bad considering the circumstances he's been in. He's been in some fairly difficult circumstances, and the camps themselves, I think, have been fairly difficult, and I'm not sure that I personally would have survived as well as what he has. And, there are some concerns, but I think he has, in the circumstances, within the limitations, survived reasonably well.
And how is it that he ended up being captured by U.S. forces and brought there?
I can't talk about that except the things that are, again, publicly known, that he was picked up by the Northern Alliance in northern Afghanistan on the 9th of December. The Northern Alliance handed him over to the American authorities, and he was brought out to Guantanamo Bay. You know, I should say that the Australians were in Afghanistan at that time, and presumably he could have been handed over to the Australian authorities, but he wasn't.
And can you talk about how you became the first lawyer to visit a prisoner there?
I'm not sure exactly how I became the first lawyer. No one said we picked you because of anything. I've been working on this case for 2 years, and with the assistance of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, we had issued court proceedings challenging the president's order and David Hicks's detention. As you've previously said, that matter has now worked its way up to the Supreme Court, where the court will determine whether or not U.S. courts have jurisdiction over the detainees in Guantanamo Bay. And I think that's a significant factor. The other factor was President Bush was recently in Australia, and I had asked the Prime Minister of Australia, Mr. Howard, to raise the issue with Mr. Bush, particularly requesting that the Australian citizen be allowed the same standard of rights that Mr. Walker Lynn, the American citizen, got. Unfortunately, Mr. Howard didn't do that and simply asked Mr. Bush whether he'd hurry the matter up. I think that may have had something to do with the fact that I got to Guantanamo Bay.
I'd like to get back to Richard Samp and ask him about the Guantanamo situation. Clearly, the Ninth Circuit Court was raising the issue of international law as well as domestic U.S. law. That apparently, well, either these are prisoners of war, in which case they have certain rights under the international law, or they are criminals or alleged criminals that the United States now has in a territory that is where the United States flag certainly flies in Guantanamo, where U.S. sovereignty is being exercised. Your response to the question of the international dimensions of holding these people for so long?
First of all, much of what was cited by Judge Reinhart in his decision as so-called international law is not something that has ever been accepted by the United States. Many of these are treaties that we have never ratified for precisely the reason that we don't want to make them enforceable in our courts. I do agree that there is much to be said for the United States acting in a way that that gives us the good opinion of the rest of the world. It doesn't do us any good to make enemies out of Australia and Great Britain by mistreating citizens of those countries at Guantanamo Bay, and therefore it's in our interest to make sure that that we treat them well. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that the answer for someone like Mr. Hicks is to go into American courts. Rather, the answer is for citizens of Australia and the Australian government to put diplomatic pressure on the United States, and that, I understand, is going on, and the result is the access that Mr. Hicks has to an attorney, plus the fact that I understand that there has been a guarantee that Mr. Hicks would not be given the death penalty even if convicted by a military tribunal.
Barbara Olshansky?
Well, I think I have to disagree with Mr. Samp on a number of points, the first of which is that what we have in Guantanamo is both a legal and moral black hole. And the position of the administration has been that neither domestic American law applies there, nor even military law. And so what we have is sort of a third universe where the government feels free to pick and choose what it wants to apply. And I think that's very disturbing for a country that is premised on the rule of law. Second, you know, this notion that there are no international covenants or treaties that apply is just really incorrect. The 1949 Geneva Conventions were signed and ratified by the United States. And, you know, the one Article 5 of the Third Geneva Convention makes really clear that people are entitled to a determination by a neutral tribunal as to whether or not they're a prisoner of war. And Juan is right. If you're a prisoner of war, the conventions require that you be treated to the same justice system as American soldiers. And that means going through the Uniform Code of Military Justice years. And if you've committed a crime, a war crime, being tried in front of a court-martial, if that doesn't apply, then you are a civilian and you must go into the criminal court system. And so either Mr. Hicks is a prisoner of war because he fought for an army of a recognized nation state, whether we liked that country or not, the Taliban was the government. And if he was fighting for the Taliban, then he's a prisoner of war. And if he wasn't, and we think he did something else wrong, then he must be put into American criminal courts. And the fact is that some law has to apply there, and that not only is it morally wrong for us to say that there isn't any law, but what are the ramifications for our own people all over the world if we set this bad example here and our soldiers are captured elsewhere? Is this what we want to say, that you can create your own justice system for whatever you want to try our soldiers? I don't think so.
Richard Samp?
Well, it is correct that the Geneva Convention of 1949 does apply, and what it says is that if the government has significant doubts as to what the person's status should be, it should hold a tribunal to make that determination. The government has said it's very clear that none of the Taliban soldiers were a regular army. They were not wearing uniforms and openly bearing arms, and therefore they are not prisoners of war. But even if they were considered prisoners of war, holding them in Guantanamo Bay would be 100% correct. They are not entitled to any sort of criminal proceeding. They are entitled to be held, detained at a prisoner of war camp for the duration of hostilities.
I want to go to another point, which is the third whammy for the Justice Department, or for the Bush administration yesterday, the Justice Department investigation into the treatment of 911 detainees at a federal prison in New York, revealing physical and verbal abuse by as many as 20 prison guards, a report issued yesterday from the department's inspector general citing systemic problems in the way detainees were treated at Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. Among the problems detailed, unnecessary and inappropriate use of strip search, searches, banging on detainees' cell doors excessively while they're trying to sleep. And then this interesting statement within the report: we did not find evidence that the detainees were brutally beaten, but we found evidence some officers slammed and bounced detainees against the wall, twisted their arms and hands in painful ways, stepped on their leg restraint chains, punished them by keeping them restrained for long periods of time. Barbara Olshansky.
Well, this is quite an amazing report. We filed the case Turkman versus Ashcroft in April of last year, and when we filed that case, we had a guess at what was happening to immigration detainees. We got in eventually to see them, and we knew, for example, that Mr. Joffrey, one of our plaintiffs, had had this happen to him, had his face repeatedly slammed into the wall to the extent that it really dislocated his jaw, broke several teeth. He was really in dire need of a dentist. He had other bruises because the Inspector General report said here did happen to him. His shackles, they were shackled hands to feet to waist, were used to drag people around. They were stepped on. They were yanked. People were really quite badly abused. And what this report did really is...
let's emphasize, this is the Justice Department, the Inspector
right.
General of the Justice Department.
Right.
Report.
And I think that, and you're correct to emphasize that. You know, that has, you know, really given us some hope that there are mechanisms within the government that are uncovering what is going on. And the extent of which, at which the Office of the Inspector General was able to sort of uncover and reveal conflicting statements by the guards that participated by showing very concretely how they violated the policy of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and by talking very specifically and showing examples. There are still photos taken from videotapes of how all of this type of abuse happened. And the fact of the videotapes is really quite
astounding. These are prison videotapes.
Yes, they are. And What we have now learned is that there was a directive that came from higher offices in the Justice Department to destroy those videotapes, that they didn't have to be kept more than 30 days. They encouraged people to recycle them and or destroy them. But for some reason, many of them were kept, not all by any means, but many of them were. And the videotapes actually reveal this systemic abuse that was happening to these folks.
I'd like to ask Richard Samp, just in a general sense. We've been discussing a variety of cases. I've heard the arguments made that 911 has basically changed everything, and that in essence, the protections that we had previously cannot be looked at in the same way. But the possibility of a complete abrogation of the Bill of Rights in the process of fighting this war on terrorism, it seems to other people to be looming. What's your response to that?
I think the Bill of Rights is a very important document. Our organization is fighting constantly to ensure that those rights are upheld. I don't think that the war on terrorism changes anything fundamentally in this country. We still have a rule of law. I support the right of people like Mr. Hamdi and Mr. Padilla to file writs of habeas corpus and to present evidence that says that they, in fact, did not assist the Taliban, and if Mr. Padilla can show that he was not meeting with Taliban leaders in Afghanistan at the time the government said he was, he ought to be set free. And I think that the fact that we've got an office of the Inspector General that's looking over the shoulder of prison conditions shows that the government is treating seriously the idea of civil liberties. So I don't think anything has changed. On the other hand, one thing that has not changed is that foreign policy in this country and military affairs are run by the president, not by the courts.
But how can Mr. Padilla do that if he doesn't have a day in court to prove that he was or he wasn't a member of Al-Qaeda?
He ought to have a day in court, and that wasn't the issue that was decided yesterday by the Second Circuit. The arguments that have been going on up to this point was if the government has conceded his right to a day in court, and the question was, should he have a broad right of review, or should he be limited to the very narrow right of review that the government had been pushing for? But the Second Circuit bypassed that entire issue by simply saying the government can't hold him at all, regardless of how much evidence they have that he was trying to blow up an American city.
Barbara Oshansky, you're shaking your head.
I guess I have to once again disagree with Mr. Samp, because the government's position in the Padilla case was that he did not have, there were no conditions under which they could agree to get him to see his attorney. They just refused to agree to set those conditions. Judge Mukasey said he has to have access to counsel. If in order for the writ of habeas corpus, for him to test his detention, for me to examine this, he has to have counsel to help him present his case. And the government came back and said, there are no conditions that we will agree to let him meet with his lawyer. And that really means that that writ, that right to get to court, was completely obliterated in the government's view. They didn't want him to be able to make that meaningful argument. Otherwise, they would have given him the right to counsel. And, you know, I do think that this administration has fundamentally undermined the Bill of Rights. And, you know, what I want to say about that is the people in the Turkman versus Ashcroft case, these folks that were beaten in the Metropolitan Detention Center, they committed civil immigration violations. They didn't commit any crime. There was no allegation of crime, no allegation of terrorist activity. They had overstayed tourist visas. And when an immigration judge said it's okay for them to come home, the Justice Department, the FBI, and the INS said that they can't stay until we clear them. They are guilty until proven innocent. And they were held for up to 2 years without any rights. That is not in keeping with the Bill of Rights.
I just wanted to ask Richard Samp if of the Washington Legal Foundation, a conservative legal organization, often at odds with the Center for Constitutional Rights. But in this day and age, in this post-911 era, a question about whether liberal and conservative lines are breaking down right now, that there are deep concerns among conservatives about the Bill of Rights, about privacy rights, about legal protections. Would you say that it, more often than not now you're finding yourself perhaps more sympathetic to the arguments of groups like the Center for Constitutional Rights?
I wouldn't go quite that far. Well, obviously,
but the Cato Institute and the Rutherford Institute were, because they actually filed briefs with the center.
That's correct. The Cato Institute is usually considered to be a libertarian organization, which is one that, for example, on philosophical grounds, opposes anything that restricts privacy rights. So, for example, they strongly support access to what are now illegal drugs, and don't think that the war on drugs is a good thing. I agree that I think conservatives have always been wary of big government and are concerned if they think that the government is going too far to undermine the civil rights of Americans. On the other hand, I think that conservatives realize that the government must take effective steps to defend themselves, or we won't have a government very much longer. I think that all conservatives that I'm aware of are at least concerned about the detention of American citizens. I don't know any conservative who, for example, defends the detention on the basis of race of Japanese during World War II. If I thought, for example, that Mr. Padilla was being held simply because he had converted to Islam, that would be a serious concern of mine. But everything I have seen suggests that the only reason he is being held is that the government has credible evidence that he was trying to blow up an American city. The difficulty with saying, why don't you put him into the criminal system, is my understanding is that the only evidence against him is the testimony of captured al-Qaeda leaders being held in other places around the world. And I don't think it's a realistic possibility that you would put those people onto the witness stand and get them to testify against him, Mr. Padilla. So if you really don't have that criminal option, what the Second Circuit told us yesterday was you essentially have to allow somebody to go free, even though you have what you believe is credible evidence that he was trying to destroy American society.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. Richard Samp is chief counsel of the Washington Legal Foundation in Washington. Barbara Oshansky, assistant legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Her book is called Secret Trials and Executions, Military Tribunals and the Threat to Democracy, of Seven Stories Press. And also having joined us on the line, Stephen Kenny, the Australian lawyer who became the first lawyer to visit a prisoner on Guantanamo Bay, his client, David Hicks. You are listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. 5 days after the announcement of the capture of Saddam Hussein, the killings in Iraq continue. Earlier in the week, U.S. troops said they killed 11 Iraqis who were planning an ambush. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, at least 10 people died, 15 injured when a fuel tanker exploded. On Monday, at least two Iraqi police stations came under attack, leaving 9 dead. In Samarra, U.S. forces raided the city, arresting 80 Iraqis over the past 2 days. Agence France-Presse reports U.S. troops stormed into houses in the middle of the night and blew up doors and gates with explosives to gain access to locked homes. Pro-Saddam rallies were reportedly held in Fallujah, Ramadi, and Mosul. And as we reported earlier, in Tikrit, they have now been ruled illegal. Protests have been ruled illegal by the U.S. occupation forces. And the latest news, another U.S. soldier has died. Well, Ed Maloney, a veteran journalist who's been reporting in Northern Ireland for decades, joined us in the studio several weeks ago. He wrote the book, The Secret History of the IRA. In 1999, he successfully defeated an attempt by Scotland Yard Commissioner Sir John Stevens to force him to hand over notes of an interview with a source who alleged an official cover-up of the murder of a Belfast lawyer. And that year, he was elected Irish Journalist of the Year. After we spoke about events in Northern Ireland, after the program, we had a conversation about similarities he saw between Ireland and Iraq. This is what Ed Maloney had to say.
Well, Well, the similarities sometimes sitting here in New York watching events unfold in Iraq, looking at the way people here in the U.S. are responding to those events, the parallels between what is happening now and what happened in Ireland from the start of the Troubles onwards is sometimes so uncanny that it's weird. And I think there are very important lessons there for the U.S. and for people here about what to expect from this conflict. There are obvious differences, but there are some similarities. For example, one of the similarities is that as the U.S. went into Iraq expecting, and indeed in some cases receiving, a very positive welcome from the population who saw them as, in one way or another, as liberators, or at least some of them saw them as liberators. You had a similar situation in Northern Ireland when the British troops first came into Belfast and Derry and elsewhere in 1969. They were viewed, certainly by the Catholic population there, as liberators, as people who'd come in to rescue them from violence and the oppression that they were experiencing at the hands of their government, their unionist government, and the similarities are there. And equally, both situations went sour very quickly. In Ireland, for all sorts of reasons which are too complicated to go into, the Catholic population moved and turned against the British troops in a matter of a few months. And something very similar appears to be happening in Iraq, with large elements of the population who may at the start have been, if not enthusiastic about the American presence, at least neutral and prepared to give it a chance, now apparently moving with some force and vigor towards a sort of hostile attitude towards the U.S. And in both sets of circumstances, what happens when that occurs is that the military resistance, the violent resistance, is given a boost because people start to join organizations to hit back. The reason why in Ireland Catholic population of Belfast and Derry moved against the British troops is because they found themselves on the receiving end of violence meted out by the British troops against them, and they wanted to strike back. And looking at what's happening in Iraq, it seems to me, for example, examining the conflicting accounts that are coming out of Samarra, something appears to have gone badly wrong there. People who were involved at the receiving end of U.S. violence in Samarra are going to want to hit back. And there's only one way that you can hit back, and that's to join up, get a gun in your hand and a bomb in your hand, and start using those weapons against the troops. And so far from pacifying or increasing support for the U.S. presence in Iraq, their actions in ways which are so uncannily similar to what happened in Ireland back in the late 60s and early 1970s, it's having the negative and reverse impact. And that means that you're in for an awfully long occupation of Iraq. And let's just look at some of the basic facts and figures. British troops went into Belfast and Derry in August 1969. They are still there in 2003. At the height of the Troubles, there were 30,000 troops stationed in Northern Ireland fighting against the IRA. The population in Northern Ireland was merely 1.5 million people. The British troops spoke the same language as the natives. They didn't maybe understand the culture, but at least they could understand what they were saying. That doesn't apply with the Americans in Iraq. In Iraq, the U.S. has a force of, I believe, about 140,000 troops, and the population of Iraq, in other words, the potential for a recruitment for opposition terrorists or guerrillas, is, I think, 40 million or thereabouts. So just do the math. It's very simple. There's no way that 140,000 troops in a situation where the local population is moving against and becoming more hostile to the U.S. troops, are going to be able to hold the thing down. And you're going to be in there for an awful long time. And if Britain was in Northern Ireland for over 30 years in a small, tiny conflict with a small population, and, you know, the IRA came from a much smaller base than 1.5 million, the Catholic population in Northern Ireland is only 600,000, 700,000 strong. So the number of potential recruits was actually very, very small and finite. And it was very close to Britain, and they spoke the same language, and they couldn't defeat the IRA. How on earth are the Americans going to defeat the Iraqis?
And what is the attitude in Northern Ireland toward what's happening in Iraq?
I think a lot of people are looking at what's happening in Iraq and saying, we've been there. We got the T-shirt, and we've got a whole wardrobe full of T-shirts, in fact. And you guys are in for a very tough time there. And, of course, the lesson from Northern Ireland, I think the other lesson that applies from Northern Ireland to the Iraq situation is that at the end of the day, the British, all the force that the British could bring to bear against the IRA, all their intelligence resources, all the money that they could spend, all the spooks and spies that they could recruit, at the end of the day didn't make any difference at all, because the violence was organic. It was coming from deep within society. And you can defeat the Baader-Meinhof gang, you can defeat the Weathermen, because they're not organic violence. They're not organic organizations. But organizations like the IRA, and I suspect the Iraqi resistance, are organic organizations. And they are, I think, almost impossible to defeat by conventional military or counter-subversion methods. At the end of the day, if there is a solution to Northern Ireland, I suspect there is a solution to Northern Ireland, it's one of compromise, but it's also essentially a political solution. It's not one that was won or secured by military victory or military defeat. It was achieved by a political settlement. And the same thing is going to have to happen, I suspect, at the end of the day in Iraq. And that means that very difficult choices are going to have to be made at some stage. And whether people are up to that remains to be seen. For example, in Ireland, in order to get this political settlement, erstwhile gunmen and terrorists, people who were reviled, people who were banned from the radio waves and television stations in Britain and Ireland for the best part of 20 years, people like Gerry Adams, have now been brought into the political system and treated as equals. I'm not saying that necessarily exactly the same thing is going to happen in Iraq, but if you're forced at the end of the day to embrace a political settlement, then those are the sort of things that have to happen.
Is it true that a few months ago, Catholics in Northern Ireland flew Palestinian flags and Protestants flew Israeli flags?
Yeah, but that's been there for a long, long time. There's been an identification on the Catholic side, on the IRA side, with the Palestinians and with the Israelis on the Unionist side. They see themselves as occupying very similar positions, albeit in different circumstances. You know. And the same thing is happening, I suspect, now with the war in Iraq, that the Catholic population is identifying with the Iraqis, and that the Unionists, along with the British, are identifying with the Americans. So that's not a surprise, no.
And then, of course, you have Britain itself involved in both conflicts.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And that in itself is a very interesting phenomenon, because the... I've heard it said that the British in Iraq are bringing their years of experience in Northern Ireland in the way that they are handling their part of Iraq, and you think back at what the British did in Northern Ireland to sustain, indeed even create, and certainly nurture the IRA over the years because of the violence that they meted out, and you say to yourself, well, if that's what they're doing in Iraq, if they brought the same methods that they used in Belfast and Derry, and they're using those methods in Basra or wherever it is in Iraq that the British are now stationed, then the Americans have got even more trouble on their laps, because this thing is going to last forever. Because these armies and these soldiers only know how to behave in one way, and that's with extreme brutality. And at the end of the day, brutality is counterproductive. It creates anger and an overwhelming desire to strike back. And that's what's happening in Iraq now. Look at the level of violence from May, when the Americans allegedly had brought the hostilities to an end and George Bush landed on his aircraft carrier. Look at the violence then and the violence now. It's grown. Why has it grown? It's grown because people want to hit back. And they're joining up in these organizations. And incidentally, in exactly the same way as the Americans have said that what is happening in Iraq is the product of foreigners coming in from outside, exactly the same thing happened in the early days of the Troubles in Ireland, that the British said it's people coming across the Irish border that are bombing Belfast. or that it's people who are being paid money, foreign gunmen, mercenaries are being paid money to shoot British soldiers. Exactly the same sort of nonsense, total nonsensical stuff. And it's said for basically the same reasons.
And that was Ed Mahoney, a veteran journalist who's been reporting on Northern Ireland for 2 decades, comparing Iraq and Northern Ireland. That does it for the program. If you'd like to get a copy, call 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. I'll be in Long Beach, California at the Long Beach Convention Center this weekend, Saturday, for the Muslim Public Affairs Committee meetings. Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire, Republic of Caduce. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.